This is Ray Berry, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 8th of July 2012. Ray Berry, Part 2.
Did you have any dodgy moments at Deception, Ray?
Yes. during the second week, I think, I was there. I was trying out my skis, and because they were monstrous, great long wooden Norwegian ski. They measured right up to your palm of your hand held high over your head. So they were really long on Alpine standards. And I sort of went out walking around the base, and I struck out across a lake, a frozen lake. And somewhere near the middle, the ice gave way in front on the front of my skis, and I sort of launched very majestically, really, underwater. And I didn't sort of panic. I was on my own, completely on my own. Nobody knew where I was or anything of that sort. And I sort of managed to get my shoulders and my elbows onto the ice at the side of the hole. And as luck would have it, some tiny wavelets of water had frozen into little ridges as they'd fanned out over the ice surface. And I just managed to get enough purchase on those to steady myself and swing my legs up, complete with skis, up out of the water onto the ice alongside the hole I'd made. And, you know, in retrospect, how I did it, I just don't know, but I just managed to get up, stand up and ski off the top of this lake, you know, completely soaking, you know, from the breastbone downwards. And my brand new camera, very expensive camera board, it was underwater. But I was muttering about that, of course. And I just 100 yards back to base, and I stripped off. And, of course, then looking at this perfectly new Contax camera that had been under the water surface in a stinky volcano water. And eventually we decided we've got to send it back to England for the winter and have it serviced at an optician's in Trafalgar Square, and I never saw that camera again till the next summer.
Mind you, that sounds like a story that could have ended very differently.
Oh, it could. I was so near. If the ice had been just a little bit weaker, or there hadn't been those little ridges for me to get a grip on, it could have been that curtains.
Did that change your attitude towards doing things in the Antarctic?
It should have done, but it didn't.
I mean, any self-respecting base commander would say no more of that.
Yes. No.
Did
no.
He?
No, nothing like that.
So there's no kind of lesson to be learned?
No. Oh, no. The base leader was Dacre Stroud, who was a retired off. He'd injured himself in the Royal Marines, funnily enough. He'd fallen off the arch over the entrance to Chatham Barracks.
So he was obviously a man who wasn't used to health and safety either.
No, they'd had a merry night, and during the night some people had put a wetsuit on the statue on the top of the gate, and he was ordered up by the Chatham commander, get that suit off there before anybody sees you. And of course he went up to get this suit off the statue over the gate, and he'd fallen and broke his legs and his back, and he had to be invalided out of the Marines. But he was fit enough to be our base commander, and he was a wonderful guy, wonderful leader. He never led us anywhere. We completely got on with our work, and he got on with what he wanted to do. He was a keen photographer, and it was great, you know, it was fine. But you're quite right, we should really have done a bit more, been a bit more cautious with the things we did. And I'm sure they did. They were later on.
They were later, but at that time they weren't. That was a culture of the day.
No.
So your crevasse moment was a bit dodgy as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was almost a year later. I was leading a party across to show them the way to get penguin eggs. Because we used to have a yearly expedition to the nearby, 4 miles away, penguin rookery, which was a huge rookery of 500,000 birds. To early in the spring, we would take their first eggs, in the knowledge, of course, that they would lay subsequent eggs, and put them down under flower for cooking, you know, throughout the winter. And of course, you know, having fresh eggs or relatively fresh eggs to cook with makes a huge difference to what you can produce, you know, in a cookhouse situation. You know, you can do get cakes better. You can even have fried eggs on with bacon and egg and all. You know, the diet is so much easier and better to manage if you've got.
You could fry a penguin egg, could you?
Oh yes, yeah. It's blue. The white is blue, clear, transparent blue, but perfectly tasty. You know, perfectly all right.
So they were going to collect these penguin eggs, then?
Yeah, and we'd just gone over the top crest of the rim of the crater. And I was walking across what seemed a perfectly sound, flat area of snow. And I just disappeared like a rocket down a 1-foot-wide crevasse. So narrow, my boots must have only just fitted it. But I was wedged in about 12 foot down with my rucksack on my back and the ice rubbing my nose and the back of my head at the same time. It took me 3/4 of an hour to get out, to get free of the rucksack, which was sent up to the surface.
Were you on your own at this point? Or?
No. We had the base clothesline wrapped around us. Because the one piece of equipment we weren't allowed to have on base was a climbing rope, because I suppose they thought that would encourage too much climbing.
Right.
So we had to find our own.
So there were two of you?
There were four of us going across to get these eggs, but the three guys up on top were tugging on this very thin rope around my waist, but I was jammed in like a cork in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of wriggling and jabbing, because when you're down a crevasse, I don't sense that you've tried, everything's slippery, you can't get a grip on anything, and you just have to wriggle and hope that the pull will take you up. And of course I was up to my waist in ice meltwater, which didn't feel cold. I was so frightened.
Mm-hmm.
I did no sensation of cold or anything like that. I was just completely panicked and full of adrenaline, you know, to get out.
So the other three guys couldn't get you out until you got out of your rucksack?
Yes, that's right. I was jammed.
And therefore
yes.
Unjammed yourself.
Yeah, that's right. And then they whisked me up to the top. Very shaky.
Did the rucksack come with you?
Yes, that went up first.
Never mind, Barry, just get his rucksack out.
Yes, but I can't remember, honestly, whether I retreated straight away to base. I think possibly I did, and I think the others went on and got the penguin eggs. Or whether they retreated as well, I can't remember. It's so long ago, but that certainly sticks in my mind as one of my risky moments.
And again, there was no modification of procedure as a result of that close call?
No, not at all, no.
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 I was intrigued. People often say they kept the penguin eggs in flour.
Yes.
What was the benefit of the flour?
It stopped air getting to them. You know, they just didn't go rotten. They just stayed virtually the same as brand new, fresh.
Right.
Mm.
Great.
And for a whole year, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a chap on Deception with you called Arthur Farrant.
That's right, yes.
Who later committed suicide.
That's right.
I just wonder what you made of that man.
Well, the first thing to say, really, is that he was very much older than the rest of us. He was 35, 40, I would think.
Twice your age, nearly.
Yes, yes. And we were all just 19, 20, 21.
Yeah.
And he was never part of the group, because we became a really quite a tight-knit group. We all knew what each other were thinking and doing and wanting and hoping, you know. The reactions between us all were really quite remarkable, looking back on it. You know, we were a group getting on well. But Arthur, you know, sadly enough, wasn't one of that group, and he was on his own. He was very... He was very conscientious in his job, and in the circumstances that the generators were always seemed to be going wrong, whether it was very frequent or not. But it was always difficult to get them going, you know, because the temperatures were so low, and perhaps the fuel would be a bit dirty, or they were tricky to keep going, and that was his entire object in life, was to keep the generators going, and he didn't always manage it. You know, so his his job had a fair element of failure in it, which didn't help him at all.
Stress.
Yes, it's very stressful, very stressful. And I think he was taken off to another base to help get the generators going at that base, because he was a proper skilled diesel mechanic. And he came back to base. I wasn't on the base at the time that he actually committed suicide. He came back to base, polished all the pipes and cleaned up his... painted the floor in the diesel room, and then went outside. And as the boat came in to relieve him, to take him back to England, he shot himself. So it's a tragic, sort of mixed-up story. But, you know, what one can make of these things? You know, what goes through people's minds who do commit suicide? It's very difficult to put yourself in their place, isn't it? In fact, I don't think you want to, do you?
Well, no.
No.
There's a note which says you think he took... he drank one that is a photographic fluid first. Would that
Yes.
Is that like alcohol?
No, that was to kill... I suppose he hoped it would kill him quite quickly, and obviously he felt it didn't. He probably... And so then he took the base 4-5, which wasn't locked away or anything like that. It was always available. All the weapons on base, we had a 303 rifle, a shotgun, and a 4-5, with plenty of ammunition for all of them. They were all readily available to any and everybody. And he just took the 4-5 and walked round the back of the base and shot himself. And he's buried in the little Whalers cemetery at Deception, because there was a tiny little cemetery with about 6-7 crosses in it from Whalers that had died, you know, in the 20s and 30s on the island.
With hindsight, do you think it would have been possible to have seen this scenario coming?
I suppose so, yes. But on base, one gets totally involved in what you've got to do yourself, and what your cooperation and working with the other people on the base is. And, well, that should have really included him, but he was outside the loop. You know, his age difference and his personality was totally different from the rest of us. He wasn't what we call an outside man. He wasn't somebody that wanted to go skiing or mountaineering or anything of that sort.
Do you know why he was there?
We got the impression that some years, some posts were difficult to fill, and that occasionally people would get sent down that were perhaps on the borderline of whether they should, because of their skill. In one respect, that's always going to be so, isn't it? In a job that's not going to appeal to everybody, you're always going to get people that are less or more suited to it, aren't you? You know, the outside life is life in Antarctica is so totally different from any life in any other setup, isn't it? That you're going to get a perfect combination of skills quite rarely. You know, I think that's one of the things the Shackleton expedition shows, that he was an expert at choosing people to go with him, especially in his last thing, the Endurance.
I mean, FID's records are quite good at choosing the right people, and there was always that safety valve of spotting the wrong on the voyage south, wasn't there, in your day?
Yes.
So I wonder why they appointed somebody who was twice the age of everybody else.
Just don't know. I just assumed that it was, you know, there weren't enough applicants.
There's a shortage of diesel.
Diesel mechanics.
Mechanics.
Yes.
Was that because of the rebuilding of Britain, or?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, at that time, in Britain, you could any job you could get, whatever job you wanted, you could do.
You could walk into it.
Yes. Yes. And because there was such a shortage of people, and industry was booming, and hospitals were being built, you know, roads were being built.
Lots of men hadn't come back.
Yes, yes. And, you know, looking back on it, I just get the feeling that I could have done absolutely anything, you know. But, you know, I had one object in mind at the time, so I did that. But, yes, I mean, you could get a job. The poor youngsters today, it's so sad for them, isn't it?
So when you were, I think, elsewhere, you were at Signy, weren't you, when the news broke?
Yes.
That was on the radio. Were you shocked or...
I was quite shocked. And I felt for them. I mean, the chaps left behind to deal with it, it must have been terrible for them. Mm. Yes, yes. Years later, I met a chap that had been on a base where three people had killed, were died, and he was, his view of Antarctica was totally changed by that. He was just didn't want to know about it. It was ruined the whole experience for him, which is totally understandable, isn't it? The, you know, losing three people, and quite a, I think two or three bases lost.
Yes.
Threes, didn't they? It must have been devastating. Must have been terrible for them.
Was there any sign that deception might blow up when you heard the news years later? Were you surprised?
I was, yes, because it had just been hot spring activity. We'd never felt any shaking or rumbling or anything of that sort. And I heard it on Radio 4, actually. They did an interview with a base leader who'd been chased off.
Would have been the Home Service in those days.
The Home Service, yes. And he said how during one night there was this banging and crashing and moaning and groaning and the ground was shaking. And in the middle of the night, the chaps had walked round from the other base, from the Argentinian base. They'd walked round because their base had been entirely wrecked. Hmm. So I think it was right to abandon Deception, actually, as a base. I think it would have been silly to spend a lot of money there. As it is, they'd built a hangar and quite a few things there, and they'd flattened the aerodrome a bit. But, I mean, there'd been sort of runs of ash and stuff had come down near the base, and it was quite shaken up, quite ruined, really. Mm. So it was a good thing to get out of there, I think.
Yeah. OK. Well, you moved on at the end of your first winter. You moved on to Signia. I'm wondering whether you volunteered for that.
Yes.
You did.
Yes.
Did you ask to be sent to Signia? Or
no,
you...
No. We were directed. But that was OK. I was quite happy to go there.
A bit further south?
No. It was the northernmost base.
Oh, right. I beg your pardon.
But funnily enough, it was one of the better ones. The two best bases were really, from a weather point of view, were Argentine Islands, which was farthest south, and Signia Islands, which was the farthest north, because the Signia Islands were over the entrance to the Weddell Sea, and they used to get cold winds, cold, different atmosphere coming up, different air masses coming up from the Weddell, and they would get quite cold spells. We had, actually, while I was at Signia, we had minus 40 for about a fortnight, 2 weeks, and that was quite an experience.
What do you mean? What sort of effect did it have on daily life?
Oh, well, I mean, minus 40 is quite, you know, things begin to feel really cold. I mean, our breakfast cups used to freeze to the table in the morning in the hut. And when we were writing up our report, we'd have our feet in the oven and the ink on top of the hot plate. Because we were in a very primitive hut, single skin hut. And it was really cold when it was minus 40 and a bit of a wind outside. But it was only for a fortnight, so we soon got... That was soon the thing of the past.
Did the hut come as a bit of a shock after the palatial facilities at Deception?
Yeah, it was, really, yeah. Yeah, it's because it was very small. Mm. Just one big room with the kitchen sort of built, all part of it, and the range, you know, the sort of Arga cooker-type thing on one side, and then it's a great big cold water tank next to it where we used to thaw out the snow blocks. And... because we'd have to put snow blocks in it every day, or every other day at least, and skim the occasional penguin feather off the top of that, or worse. it was very, very small hut, and of course the diesel engines were in a separate Nissan hut, which was absolutely like ice in there, of course. But it was quite primitive at Sydney at that time.
So a bit of a come down for you?
No, just different.
The weather was different too, wasn't it? It was terribly manky at Signia.
It could be, yes. Although, of course, when we had this cold snap, it was beautiful blue sky. Mm. And Signia was blessed with the most fantastic layered cloud over Coronation Island. You would get, what do they call it, lenticular clouds forming over Coronation Island. They'd be 12 layers thick, just going up and up and up, you know, into the stratosphere. Amazing cloud formations to look at, because it was right out in the ocean, so the air streams would just pop up over the top of it and cool down. and the cloud would form as say in layers. It was really, really very pretty, like a wedding cake sort of set up. Yes. Oh, no, it was. And the skiing was quite nice. And of course, we had elephant seals on Cygnet, which were a new departure. We hadn't seen these great big monsters. And actually, we'd be eating, having our meals with the elephant seals belching 100 yards away, accompanying them, accompanying our food. So that was quite intriguing. Yes.
What else can you remember about Cygnet? I mean, what was your. Was the weather pattern distinctly different?
Yes, it was more oceanic, of course, except, as I say, when we had this one burst of cold. But we'd get clouds blowing in with what we called trailing verga, which was sort of like a shower coming out of the tail end of it. That was quite striking. Lots of different atmospheric phenomena. And we didn't have... The year I was there, we didn't have good sea ice. So right. Although we went out skiing, it was just strictly on the ice cap of the island. And we used to mosey around, do a little bit of rock climbing. We had one chap that was quite keen on rock climbing, and there was a little cliff near the base, which we used to climb on. That was quite good. And lots of birds, of course, on Cygnet. It's more, being warmer, being more in oceanic, we had different birds, prions and shag and all sorts of things, all sorts of birds.
Was there any science being done, apart from met work?
There was a lot of science done at Cygnet because they realised... Pretty well, round about the time I was there, they realised there was lots and lots of insects and lichens and moss, areas of moss growing. It was all the beginnings of really global warming that Cygnet was one of the islands which was warmed up sufficient.
Already in the 1950s?
Yes, to have its own little bits and pieces of green. So that was quite interesting. And the science got into it very quickly and found there were insects and springtails and things living under the ice surface. So it became quite a research centre. And, of course, they built a very good hut there 2 or 3 years after I was there.
Did the words or the thought global warming cross your mind?
No, not really.
At that point?
No, it wasn't currency but, then. But it was a year or two later that really notice was taken of how quickly... glaciers were retreating. And
so even in the mid to late 50s, people were getting suspicious, were they?
Beginning to, yes. Somebody was measuring somewhere or another the CO2 content, and I think they were beginning to realise that the Industrial Revolution had had some effects that they should really get worried about.
That's interesting, because it was another 30 years before the paper appeared in Nature magazine.
Yes, yeah. And I was reading Rachel Carson's Spring, Silent Spring, whether that was just round about that time or just after. So, you know, some people realise that... Oh, of course, that was mainly to do with DDT, wasn't it? But, you know, some people were realising that things were at risk, you know, things were changing.
So, again, when 30 years later you picked up the newspapers and saw the story about the three BASS scientists who'd found the ozone hole.
Yes.
This wasn't a huge surprise.
Well, funnily enough, that deception, we'd unpacked the one of the first ozone measuring instruments, which was Dobson's spectrometer. Unfortunately, a crucial part of it wasn't sent down, so we didn't get it going the year I was there. But I was at Argentine for my last year with... a top-notch scientist at Ross Hesketh, and we unpacked. We got a lot of magnetic equipment working, you know, measuring the magnetic force, all getting ready for the IGY, the International Geophysical Year, which was the next year or 2 years ahead. But he was a great base leader, and I got on with very well. You know, we built the magnetic hut and got the radios on going, measuring upper air temperatures and pressures.
So you were taking readings in 55 at Argentine Island, which were the very beginnings of the records that the scientists used to establish the ozone problem.
Just at the very, very tip of that, yes. Yeah.
So when you did see the story in the press, what was your feeling about that?
Well, I was quite surprised, and I was really bucked. It's the thing that Fids and Bass have, you know, sort of discovered and... brought to the fore, and of course it all came to a very good result in that, you know, CFCs were banned.
Mm.
And, you know, the whole is repairing itself very slowly, a bit, but it has got results. And, but sadly, people have sort of pushed it to the back of their minds now, haven't they? But it was a good result.
Well, there was an anniversary quite recent, I think 21 years or 25 years.
Yeah, that's right.
When it came back into popular consciousness again for a while.
Yes, yes.
When you came to the end of your year at Signy, you had, well, I guess you had to come home. You were.
That's right, yes.
Did you ask for an extension? Or did they?
Yes, yeah, I wanted to go back for another 2 years. I loved
but
it.
But did you ask to stay? Or were you
no,
always
no,
going to come home?
I had to come back to England to have a sort of bit of a holiday and a break.
Mm.
And, you know, I went holidaying with my parents and bought a pair of proper skis in Switzerland and took them back the next year, of course. And, it was a good idea, I think, to return to Britain, even though it meant such a lot of, you know, slogging up through the Atlantic, but, you know, the slow old Biscay. But I was really looking forward to another 2 years, but unfortunately I didn't quite get the job that I was anticipating.
Well, what happened? Tell me the story.
Well, I'd been trained in Radio Sonde while I was on holiday in Britain in that intervening year.
Was that another element of the long game, was it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. It was sending up a balloon and measuring the upper winds and temperatures, you know, up to 70,000 feet. So it was quite a big thing. And
Had you trained yourself off your own bat?
No. It was organised through the Met Office, right. Yes, yeah.
So when he came back, sorry, Ray, when he came back, you'd already established you were going to go down south again.
Yes, that's right.
And they sent you on this training course.
That's right.
Okay.
To Argentine Islands, where that equipment was going to be based.
All right, so part of the deal was you had to go somewhere that was like Switzerland.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, of course, the Argentines is fabulous. I did the year at Argentine Islands with Ross Hesker setting up the equipment, but I was hoping to get a bit more money and be the head of the Met office section at Argentine in my last year. And unfortunately, they didn't see it quite the same way. So they didn't think I could head up the Met. They sent somebody else down. So I thought, I'll blow it. I'll go back to England.
So you did 1 year rather than two?
1 year, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And apart from looking a bit like Switzerland, what was the Argentine Islands like?
Well, it was very, very good because it's really Antarctic, you know. We've been subsequently to McMurdo Sound, and you can see it's real. Once you get south of the circle by a long way, you know, of course, the Argentine says it's not south of the circle, but it's pretty close to it. And you get the real Arctic weather, perfectly calm, still winter's night, winter's days. You know, and of course you get what they call diamond dust. You get this sprinkling of diamond-like crystals falling out of a clear blue sky, and it's absolute magic. Everything becomes dusted in a sort of icing sugar, and it's just amazing sort of atmospheric trick that can really blow your mind. You know, when it gets really cold, you get that the last vestige of water vapor is frozen out of the air. You know, we get down to minus 10, minus 20. And this sprinkling out of no cloud, just this diamond-like particles falling out of the sky. It's just totally magic, really great. But, and of course, you get that in northern Canada. That happens there as well. But, and a tremendous mirage. I mean, we were seeing islands that were 200 miles away suddenly pop up over the horizon, you know, where we knew perfectly well there was no land for 200 miles. You'd suddenly see an island. You know, the bending of the light rays through cold layers of air. Just amazing. You know, it really blows your mind when you think, crumbs, I didn't know there was an island. You know, so you get that crisp cold day, you know, one day after the other. I mean, we used to get cold days at the other bases, but it would just be occasional, and it would be interspersed, you know, with, you know, temperatures coming up to near freezing, not above freezing, but near freezing, and you get gales and dark overcast days, you know, for a whole 2 weeks at a time. You could get Admiralty Bay, especially, was very overcast because the cold depressions are blowing in, you know, from the open sea there. Mm. But when you get really down close to the continent itself, you get that more continental climate, mm. which is so Antarctic-like, you know. It's just magic.
So how was it for you socially? I mean, the fact that you had your nose being put out of joint slightly by not getting the top job, or
no,
did you just muck along with you all?
No, just ignore it, get on, everybody. I did notice, though, that for the first time I came across people that never went out of the hut.
What?
That sounds extraordinary, doesn't it? But we had three people in Argentine Islands who never left the hut the whole year. And it does seem absolutely amazing, but they just didn't. They weren't interested in going out into the snow and the cold and, you know, skiing around and testing the sea ice and, you know, everything that made the whole thing attractive to me was certainly not attractive to them. They were just doing a job and collecting a year's money. And
then were they scientists or were they...?
Yes, mainly technical people. Yeah. It seems so sad.
Yes.
So sad. I couldn't believe it.
So did you get out much to Argentina? I'm not quite sure about the sledging status of Argentina.
Yes, actually, for the first time, I went out dog sledging
right.
with four dogs, only a tiny, tiny bit, really, over the sea ice and collecting more collecting penguin eggs. And on that occasion when we were collecting there, we saw an emperor penguin go by, which was quite rare, you know, heading south. We occasionally we'd take out a tent to a nearby island and pitch it up for two nights and do the proper Antarctic, you know, with a pyramid tent, you know, like Scott used to have, and the Primus, and, you know, having a crap in the corner of the tent and that sort of thing. all the proper Antarctic stuff.
Did you feel, I mean, you're only just about 40 years after Scott, weren't you? So
yes.
He was within the generation.
Yes, almost, yes.
Effectively.
Yeah.
Did you feel close to him?
Or
because you were living a life similar to his in Shackleton?
Not really, because Scott has an awful press, you know, because one section of people make him to be the martinet and officer class, and in a way he was, because at McMurdo Sound, where the Scott's hut, the loo is outside. And it's in two distinct parts, officers and men. And when you think of that, you think, what was he thinking of? Mm. But in total contrast to Shackleton, of course, who there was none of that officers and men business.
What I meant was, I suppose, you were living in conditions that were not dissimilar from the heroic era.
No.
Things have changed dramatically since, whereas actually were almost the same.
Yes, it was.
Circumstances
yes, it was.
As...
Yeah. Yeah,
the turn of the century, guys.
You could say that, yes, but and we were quite mad at the things we did and the freedom we had to do things. All the rubbish was dumped over the cliff, and things like that. Absolute horror now, aren't they? Mm. You know, everything has to be brought back. But you know, killing seals and penguins to eat. You can't do nothing like that occurs now. No dogs, cooks. Oh no, fancy sending cooks. I mean, how can you cook for a year for 10 men? I mean, that must be an impossible job. How can you remain interested in your job? I don't know how they manage it. They're heroes, I think, people that go down there and cook. But no, it's completely changed now. It's a completely different thing. But it's changed for the better, really, because the results are better, the science is better. I mean, yesterday we were looking at snow cores, ice cores rather.
Bass HQ.
Yes, and they are fabulous. It's just amazing what they can find out about past climate, which is so important, you know, to know how the climate is changing. And, of course, that pins it down. That just shows you irrefutably, you know, what's been going on. So the science is streets ahead of what it was, of course. Even bearing in mind, you know, the high point of finding the ozone hole, the science is way ahead now, I think.
I was fascinated yesterday, they were talking about the drilling to the Ellsworth Lake.
Yes.
And actually reaching water that hasn't been exposed for millions of years.
Yeah. And I mean, it's going to be more than interesting, isn't it? It's going to be... What they'll find is just anybody's guess, isn't it?
Meanwhile, back on Argentine Island in 1955, Mr. Berry was yet again causing a trail of havoc. you were a danger to shipping at one point.
Oh, that's right, yes. The first day that the sea ice began to form, I thought, well, this is too good a chance to miss. I'll sort of do an icebreaker act with the little wooden dinghy that we had. And I sort of pushed the dinghy out for the last time that summer, and motored around through this very, very thin ice, you know, making pretty patterns in it, and figure of eights and circles, and pushing lumps of ice hither and yon. But when I got back to shore, I'd realised that I'd almost cut through the planking of the dinghy all round, and I had to very quickly put lots of copper patches on it for the next year so it could be used. That was a bit of a no-no. But the dinghy business was good fun in the dinghy in the summer, because the water was flat calm always, really, at Argentine Islands. It was like a mill pond. No swell, nothing of that sort. Just, you could go out in the dinghy, you know, motor around the icebergs and, you know, look at them go through arches and all sorts of things, you know, with a dinghy, no problems at all.
So you were boating in the stretch of water between the Argentine island and the mainland, were you?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Sheltered area.
Yeah. But, of course, it's all flat calm there.
And what's this business about licking an anemometer?
One morning after a very, very intense period of hoar frost, everything was frosted up, you know, like icing sugar, 6 to 7 inches deep, you know, on all the metal surfaces. And I climbed up the anemometer to push the cups around, you know, just to make sure it was all free and it was pointing. And I was just sitting up there in the sun and lapping it all up, looking round at the view and thinking what a wonderful place this is. And sort of quite absent-mindedly, I poked my tongue out at the the south pointer of the on the anemometer, and my tongue stuck to it. And I thought, crumbs, what am I going to do now? Because it didn't feel particularly cold, but I couldn't get my tongue back into my mouth. So I just had to pull, and I left about a quarter of an inch square end of my tongue on the metal of the anemometer. But so it only took a couple of months to heal up. So.
Tell me a bit more about the radio sonde work, because you'd learned back in Britain, and then you specifically went to Argentine Islands so you could use your skills.
Yes.
And what were you having to do? How difficult was it?
It was a really interesting job. You had to blow up a balloon for a start, so we used to make our own hydrogen, or use a cylinder that had been sent down, just according to whether it was a fine weather or a bad day. And you'd blow up this balloon, and it would blow up to about a 6-7 foot across balloon. And then on the bottom of that, you'd have a long cable, long thin string, with a little radio transmitter on the bottom of that, which would, on the side of this transmitter, would be like a windmill. So it would connect you to a temperature sensor, humidity sensor, and a pressure sensor in order. As the windmill rotated, it would send. So you could get a signal from the radio transmitter. And the pitch of the signal would give you what the value was of the particular element that you were measuring. So you would, if it was a calm day, you'd just simply hold the balloon, hold the radio transmitter and let the balloon go, and then a few seconds later you'd let the transmitter go and it would sail up. And the balloon would go right up to 70,000 feet where it would burst and be lost, you know, just plunge down I know not where. But during the ascent, we'd be monitoring the radio signals coming in order, in rotation from the transmitter. And we'd do that by measuring on an oscilloscope, by comparing a known frequency signal with the frequency coming down from the transmitter. And then you'd balance the two signals together and you get a still circle on your oscilloscope when you've got two signals in balance. And then you read off from your vernier what the balance point is. And of course, as the balloon goes up and as it cools down, as the temperature readings change, the balance point changes. And so you get a signal coming back from the transmitter, which is something like dee, 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 dee. At each different note, you'd have to tune in on your oscilloscope and get the figure to balance it, the frequency to balance it, and then you'd plot that on a graph. And then you'd compute the things on the signals and the readings you're getting on a huge great slide rule, which was about 3 feet 6 long, with 6 different cursors on it, and a lot of slippy slide work ruling would be done between each signal. And it was a really skilled job. You had to be really slick with getting these readings, getting them down and computing as the balloon was going up. And, you know, after a lot of training, it took you a couple of months to get to know how to handle these signals quickly. You'd be able to get a really good balloon trace, you know, the temperature, pressure and humidity as the balloon went up.
So you're measuring those three things as it went up different heights.
Yes.
Yeah. And how useful was that? What did that tell you that you didn't otherwise know?
Well, of course, when you do those sort of readings in Britain, you get inversions, you get graphs which can help you calculate the cloud cover and the depth of the cloud and whether you're going to get a thunderstorm or whether you're going to get cumulus clouds or stratus cloud or cuneiform cloud. You know, it all depends on the rate of temperature, the rate the air temperature falls off as you go up. If the air gets colder as you go up and you get a cumulus cloud, and no, it's the other way around.
Take two.
I'm going back too far. But no, the air temperature gradient is very, very important for cloud cover forecasting and that sort of thing.
And was that the cutting edge of weather measurements at that time?
It was, yes. It was a very important thing that had come in during wartime. It had been a big thing, and it was carried on. And I think they're still doing it, but with automatic equipment now, of course. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, most things have been automated since then, haven't they?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
At the end of the third year, then, you were leaving Argentine Island, choosing to come back because you hadn't got the big job?
Yes. Yes, really. I thought, well, crumbs, 3 years is enough. Mm. It's time to get on with life. You know, get married, have children, so on.
And did you do all those things?
Yes. Oh, yes. I found that the parents had got quite a good house renovation business going when I got back. So I helped them for a period with that and then got on to new house building with them and then set up a little building company of my own. And I pressed on with that from then till today, really.
Still?
Well, not, you know, 4 years ago, I gave that up.
In your late 70s?
Yes. I did plan to go on to 80, but I didn't quite make it.
What do you feel that you learnt in the Antarctic has been useful in later life, in your commercial or private life?
How to get on with people. It's a really basic thing, I think. I think I got rounded off a bit. I know I was a bit of a jagged sort of person when I went, and I was those sharp edges were a bit honed off, I think, through the three periods there, and that was a good thing.
And how do you rate the Antarctic in the context of a long life?
Oh, it's in my life it's crucial. Yeah, I wouldn't be anything like I am now without that. Very important. I think it's
character forming.
Yes. When you come back to England from Antarctica, the first thing that strikes you is everything's green. And then the next thing that strikes you is that the people are a bit green. people don't seem to appreciate that there are other sorts of life from what we live here in England. You know, getting married, having children, getting a job, getting a pension, working away diligently with one or two firms, and then retiring and on a bit of a pension.
Gold watch.
There are other lives to that. And, you know, Linda's, my wife, she's sampled the lifestyles in Africa. And I've realised that, you know, earlier on, that there are other lifestyles in Antarctica where you can be dedicated to a job or to an environment. You know, how our environment controls what we are. You know, it's an unknown field, isn't it? And we're English, aren't we? We're British. This little checkerboard country with little fields and things. It sucks, isn't it? But it needn't be. Life can be completely different. You know, it needn't be computers and Facebook and Twitter. It can be something totally different. And
there can be adventure.
And the human being can adapt to it. This one quality that the human person's got is total adaptability. That to any circumstance, and Linda's sampled it in Africa with the Maasai. Can you imagine anything different? The Maasai life. But they're happy, and they live contented, complete lives. They may not live as long, not as many years, but gosh, you know, it's all light. It's all light, isn't it? And that's the thing that faces you. When you come back from Antarctica, you suddenly realise, I'm here with people that don't realise there's something else, or there can be something else. And, of course, if global warming runs its course, we'll have to face up to something else, won't we? So it's daunting but encouraging in the same way, but to realise how totally adaptable to circumstance a human being can be. Mm. You know, those men of Shackleton's living on Elephant Island waiting for him to return from South Georgia, if he ever did return. They'd adapted to their life under that little upturned boat, hadn't they? And they were making a go of it. And yeah, that's human life, isn't it? Well, it should be. To have that knowledge that you can adapt to anything that nature or the world throws at you. They are men living in the trenches in the First World War. They adapted, didn't they? Terrible. But
one of the dilemmas facing old FIDs is whether or not to go back. Mm. Some chaps are desperate to go back, other chaps don't want to spoil the memories of their magic time in the Antarctic. And you kind of went back, because you went back to Antarctica, but you went back to a different part.
Yes, yes.
When was that?
Yeah, 4 years ago we went back to the Ross Sea in a little boat, which was very similar to the Biscoe, really, relatively. You know, just 40
as
passengers.
Tourists?
Yes, yes. And we sampled it was minus 15 when we turned north again, and the sea ice was just beginning to form, just a light little porridge on the top of the sea when we turned round, and we saw Shackleton's hut and Scott's hut and the conditions they've lived in. And of course the Ross Sea is as beautiful or more beautiful than the Lemaire Channel, for instance, which is one of the top beauty spots in the peninsula. I mean, it is gorgeous when you go down the Lemaire. But So Linda's had a sample of what it's really like, and a look in the hut. Because, I mean, Scott's hut, Shackleton's hut, is very similar, but bigger than the Air Sydney hut used to be. You know, very primitive, just boards nailed on a frame and a bit of waterproof sheeting over.
Was it wall-to-wall magic, or were there reservations?
No, I loved it. I think it was wall-to-wall magic, yeah. Reservations. I can't think of any. Cost.
That one aside.
Yeah.
It's been very entertaining and very erudite of you, Ray. Thank you very much indeed.
You sure?
Well done.